The following is a lecture entitled The Yoga of Love, given by His Grace Sriman Sankarshan Dasadhikari, recorded on January 12th, 2013, in Toronto, Canada.
So, I wanted to talk about the yoga of love, because, I mean, what's life without love anyway? Pretty bleak. So, yoga means the perfection. The yoga of love is the perfection of love, you see. It's like if you have a pond of water, okay? You throw your rock in the pond, I throw my rock in the pond. What happens to those ripples that come out from those rocks? They clash eventually, you see. But if we can all throw our rock into the same spot, they become one big, one harmonious series of waves. So the yoga of love means we have to find that common central point where we can all connect on the heart level, you see. The word yoga, we may think it means acrobatics, but actually the word yoga means yoke. The etymologists have traced the English word yoke to the Sanskrit word yoga. So yoga is yoking or linking with the supreme source of existence. And the topmost, according to the ancient Vedic wisdom, the topmost system is love, because love really is the perfection of everything. Actually, every living entity thrives on love, isn't it? One time in the schoolroom, the teacher had the students do a little experiment. Every kid was given two identical plants, and they were to give the same amount of water, the same amount of fertilizer, the same amount of sunshine to each of those two plants, but to do it in a different mood. One mood: oh, my dear plant, here's your water, here's your fertilizer. In a very sweet way, to give that plant its necessities. The other plant got the same necessities, but here, take your water, here, take your fertilizer. You see? In a rude, crude way, to give the same necessities. So guess what happened to the plants of each kid? The ones that got the affection thrived, and the ones that got the rude behavior suffered. So tell me plants don't have consciousness. I don't believe it. Plants have consciousness. It's more covered, but plants also have consciousness. Every living thing has consciousness. And there's actually a supreme consciousness, which is the fountainhead or the energetic source of all forms of consciousness. So the yoga of love, which in Sanskrit is called bhakti, means to dovetail your individual consciousness with that supreme consciousness. How do you connect with anyone? Love is actually how we connect, you see. If you exploit somebody, you may be connected, but it's a gross connection and it doesn't last. Exploitative relationships break apart, isn't it? Loving relationships, truly loving relationships, endure. So, bhakti yoga, or the yoga of love, means to develop not an exploitative but a loving, serving relationship with that supreme source of existence. Actually, this is the original recycling. Now recycling is a real buzzword. Gotta recycle. Make sure to do your recycling. You gotta be environmentally responsible and do your recycling, you see. So, What does recycling mean? It means where that thing has come from, you put it back there so you keep the cycle going. You don't just, what's coming out of the earth, you have to put back to the earth. You see, you don't rape the earth, you love the earth. You see. But there's a higher level, a yogic conception of recycling, which is not widely known yet in the modern world. They need to pick up on the yogic conception of recycling. Because there is actually loving energy coming from that supreme source, supreme person. You see, there's loving energy coming from that supreme source. So we're the benefactors of that energy, that loving energy. So if we simply take and we don't recycle, we're polluting the atmosphere of the universe. Not just on the gross level, but on the subtle level, you see. This is another thing which is not understood. Gross pollution is a manifestation of subtle pollution on the psychic level, you see. So the yoga of love is a yoga of cleansing on the psychic level, the atmosphere. So when we cleanse on that level, then it filters down to the gross platform, or, you know, the air, the water, etc., our relationships, everything. So this yoga of love is a very important thing, bhakti, Sanskrit word, you see. Bhakti means pure love without exploitation. Genuine love is called bhakti in Sanskrit, bhakti yoga. That loving energy is coming from the Supreme Person, so you offer it back. Whatever love is coming, you don't just take, you give back. And the more you give back, the more you get, and the cycle becomes actually ever increasing. The amount of loving energy increases. The more we reciprocate with the Supreme in love, the loving energy geometrically expands. We live in a world now where the love energy is geometrically contracting. If you noticed, I've been around for 65 years and I noticed, you know, what's been happening on this planet. The loving energy is just, it keeps diminishing. It's like going down the drain, you see, the loving energy. Therefore, and that's manifested in so many ways. Polluted air, people going crazy with guns, you know, shooting people. You know, these are just manifestations of it. So the bhakti yoga system not only is beneficial for each one of us to bring us back to a state of perfect harmony with the Supreme Consciousness, and it put us into a state of total bliss 24 hours a day, which really is much better than being miserable. I think we would all agree with that. Not only is it beneficial individually, but it actually purifies the whole universe. And that makes it even more exciting. When you can actually live as the well-wisher, you know, conduit of the Supreme Consciousness for the entire universe. Actually, you can become a spiritual revolutionary just by your daily activities, just by the state of consciousness in which you go to work, you go to school, you run your business, or whatever you're doing, you see. So this is what I've learned from I'm very fortunate to have a great spiritual master, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. I've imbibed these lessons from him. Of course, I'm not a master of it. I'm just a student. But whatever I have learned so far, 42 years of, I try to share it because I have learned some very valuable lessons in these 42 years of practicing bhakti yoga. And I know the world desperately needs bhakti yoga, desperately. We need to have bhakti yoga presidents, bhakti yogi presidents, prime ministers, members of parliament. We don't have such caliber leaders in this planet. And it is causing great havoc. In the ancient Vedic culture, which is completely based on yogic principles, in every sphere of society, the leaders in those days were saintly kings. In Sanskrit, the word Raja means king, and Rishi means a great sage or a great saint. So these kings, they were Raja, Rishi, or you combine them, Rajarshi. They were Rajarshis. On this planet, we had Rajarshis, and we read in the ancient Vedic histories, and it was a very sublime atmosphere of peace and happiness all over the whole world. It was absolutely sublime atmosphere everywhere. There was ample food for everyone. You didn't have all these, the deserts expanding every year, you know, taking away the arable land. It was a whole different atmosphere, like heaven on earth, like the Garden of Eden we hear about, you know, from the Bible. It was a very, very sublime atmosphere on this planet. But 5,000 years ago, we entered into an age called Kali Yuga, an age of exploitation and greed, quarrel and hypocrisy. But this message of Bhakti Yoga has the power to actually reverse the age, the downward trend of the age, and bring in a wonderful spiritual renaissance, transcendental transformation of consciousness throughout the planet. That's why I've traveling all over the world. My wife, is she also here?
Outside,
yeah. She's a little tired tonight, but she and I are traveling all over the world to share this knowledge that we have gotten of how one can elevate one's consciousness through loving exchange with the supreme source of existence and actually benefit the entire world atmosphere. So I'm a little short on time tonight, and so if there's any questions, I'll try to answer them. Anyone has any question? I'll be very happy. I love questions, by the way. Challenges also are welcome. Yes?
When you have an exchange with someone that you're in a loving relationship or friendship, but you have a disagreement, and so my reaction is defense or attack back. In that split second, I need something to do.
Oh, when she is with someone in a loving relationship, and when there's any kind of disagreement, her reaction is to become defensive and closed up, and she wants to figure out what she can do in that sense.
The problem is we all have a tendency to be egocentric. That's the difficulty. The theocentrism or God-centeredness is actually the solution. When I have a relationship with someone, if you put God in the center, the Supreme Consciousness in the center of that relationship, and you both try to harmonize with the Supreme Consciousness, you see, which is absolutely pure, then that's the solution. Because if I say, well, you've got to harmonize with me, just like, I remember that old Beatles song, and it says, "We can work it out." It said, "Try to see it my way." The song was actually kind of ridiculous. "Try to see it my way, you know, we can work it out." But actually, you know, that's not the way to do. You solve a relationship problem. You got to see it my way. The thing is, we're all limited and we're all imperfect. But the Supreme Consciousness, the Supreme Person, is actually this perfect. So if I will try to harmonize and you will try to harmonize with that Supreme Person, we both agree that we're both trying to harmonize with that Supreme Person, then we have a framework or a platform in which we can actually deal with my faults and your faults, you see. That's the solution. So the God-centered concept, or the theocentric concept, is actually very, very practical in every relationship, in individuals, in government, in any institution, a corporation, a university. You see, this principle has been law. But the theocentric conception, the scientists have tried to annihilate it, you know, this idea there is no supreme. But actually there is a supreme. It's not, you can't, there's many ways to prove that actually, but I don't know, but that's another subject matter. So any other questions? Are you satisfied? Okay, yes.
Recently there were events in the United States in a public school where the response was to put armed guards in the school, and the lecture you just gave is pure nectar. And I'm wondering, how can your voice be heard there so they can include that in the decision-making?
Well, I know, I always laugh at the whole thing, because when I went to high school in the U.S. back in the 60s, we prayed, the whole school, we prayed together every morning, and there was no guns. But the Supreme, one lady from my town, Austin, Texas, she decided, well, you know, I don't want my kid to have to hear a prayer at school, so I think we should, I don't think any kids in the whole country should have to hear a prayer in the school, because I don't want my kid to hear a prayer in the school. Now, they could have said, okay, give the kid a separate room. There's a separate room for the kids who don't want to hear the prayer. Let them, you know, study, talk philosophy or something, you know, about morality or something during the prayer time. But they said, no, so this one little child doesn't have to hear the prayers. We're not going to let any prayers be said in any school in the whole country from now on. That was the wonderful decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. And the result was drugs and guns replaced God. And they can't figure, they're trying to figure out, why is there so much violence going on? But they don't have the brains to understand. We kicked out God, and this is the result. They just don't have the brain. The leaders, the presidents, the senators, the House of Reps, these people, the Supreme Court, they don't have the brains to understand, by as soon as you take God out of the center, then all kinds of havoc is going to break loose. So, I mean, I'm writing about it on the internet. I mean, I've even written, you know, I've sometimes have written the president. I never read the letters anyway. Written the president of the United States, you know. But it's very difficult, because they just want to, they want to stay, whatever keeps them in power, that's what they do. Whatever gets them votes. Right or wrong is not the thing for them. Whatever keeps them in power is really what the bottom line is. They don't have the ability to discriminate, really discriminate between right and wrong. It's my, whatever keeps them in power, that's what they, the agenda they put forward so they get the votes. The electorate is not educated in this either. So the real solution is we have to educate the electorate who vote for the leaders that we need to get back to a God-centered conception. We're not talking about any particular religion or a state religion or anything like that, but we're talking about the state should be in favor of religious principles, of a God-centered concept. It could be, you know, that embraces all concepts of Allah, Jehovah, Christ, etc., Krishna, you know. It's not some sectarian thing, but the principle of a supreme being should not be denied, and to offer respect and obedience to that supreme being should not be kicked out of the schools. Because as soon as you do that, then all havoc comes, and the proof is there. Children, not only the people come into the schools, the children themselves bring guns to schools, as we saw in the Columbine in Colorado. That was high school kids themselves doing it on the other high school kids. You see? So this problem is just escalating more and more, and they're not getting the solution. That's why I'm not only speaking this, I'm recording it, it's going on the internet. And, you know, and we're aggressively trying to, I got 14,000 people on my list. We're trying to expand this thing so more and more people can understand. We have to have a theocentric conception back in the root of the society.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
How can you control your fears and negative thoughts? And also, do we have to know?
Let me get the first question. What did he say?
How can we get rid of fears and negative thoughts?
Or do you have to know evil to know good?
Do you have to know evil to know good?
Actually, we already know evil quite well. We're growing up in a very evil situation. Now, the real thing is that this transcendental meditation, you know, like here, like we're chanting some mantras, some sacred mantras. This is the ancient system from India, and it's very practical in this age. In fact, it's stated in the Brihadnaradiya Purana. Then if in this age, if you will vibrate the holy names of God, it could be Allah, Jehovah, Krishna. It's not any particular sectarian conception. But if you can vibrate the holy names of the Supreme Being according to your own tradition or your language, that has a purifying effect on the consciousness. If you, good thoughts drive away bad thoughts. And the best good thought is devotion to the Supreme. Because when you water the root, all the leaves and branches are nourished automatically. So when you give loving devotion through your meditation to the Supreme Person, that since everyone is part and parcel of Him, that love then filters out to every single living entity in the universe. So therefore we recommend that one should meditate on the holy names of God by chanting them as we're doing here. This chanting is enchanting. And the more you become enchanted with God or the Supreme, the less you become enchanted with the selfish, greedy things which very much have enchanted us in the modern age. You understand? Does that make sense? Okay. So anything else? Okay, well, I thank you all so much for your time and attention. And I very much appreciate your coming tonight to participate in this Bhakti Yoga evening of transcendental bliss, to swim in the ecstasy of the waves of love of the Supreme. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.